One morning, there was a knocking on the door of the driver's quarters, and when I went out, Pinky Madam was standing with two rackets in her hand. A net had been tied between two poles in one corner of the courtyard. She got on one side of the net, and I got on the other side. She hit the shuttle. It rose up, and then fell near my foot.
"Hey, move! Hit it back!"
"Sorry, madam, I'm so sorry." I'd never played this game before. I hit the shuttle back to her, and it went straight into the net.
"Oh, you're useless. Where is that other driver?"
Ram Persad dashed up to the net at once. He had been watching the game all the time from the side. He knew exactly how to play badminton. I watched him hit the shuttle cleanly over the net and match her shot for shot, and my belly burned. Is there any hatred on earth like the hatred of the number two servant for the number one? Though we slept in the same room, just a few feet apart, we never said a word to each other. Never a hello or how's your mother doing? Nothing. I could feel heat radiate out from him all night. I knew he was cursing me and putting spells on me in his sleep. See, he began every day by bowing in front of at least 20 pictures of various gods he kept in his side of the room and saying, "Om, Om, Om." As he did this, he looked at me through the corner of his eye as if to say, "Don't you pray? What are you? A Naxal?" One evening I went to the market and bought 2 dozen of the cheapest idols of Hanuman and Ram I could find, and brought them back and packed them into the room. So both of us now had the same number of gods in the room, and we drowned out each other's prayers in the morning while bowing before our respective deities. The Nepali was hand in hand with Ram Persad. One day he burst into my room and put a big plastic bucket down on the floor with a thud. "Do you like dogs, village boy?" he asked with a big smile. There were 2 white Pomeranians in the house, Cuddles and Puddles. The rich expect their dogs to be treated like humans, you see. They expect their dogs to be pampered and walked and petted and even washed. And guess who had to do the washing? I got down on my knees and began scrubbing the dogs, and then lathering them and foaming them, and then washing them down and taking a blow dryer and drying their skin. Then I took them around the compound on a chain, while the King of Nepal sat in a corner and shouted, "Don't pull the chain so hard, they're worth more than you are." By the time I was done with Puddles and Cuddles, I walked back, sniffing my hands. The only thing that can take the smell of dog skin off a servant's hands is the smell of his master's skin. Mr. Ashok was standing outside my room. I ran up to him and bowed low. He went into the room. I followed, still crouched over. He bent low to make his way through the doorway. The doorway was built for undernourished servants, not for a tall, well-fed master like him. He looked at the ceiling dubiously. "How awful," he said. Until then I had never noticed how the paint on the ceiling was peeling off in large flakes, and how there were spiderwebs in every corner. I had been so happy in this room until now. "Why is there such a smell? Open the windows." He sat down on Ram Prasad's bed and poked it with his fingertips. It felt hard. I immediately stopped being jealous of Ram Prasad. And so I saw the room with his eyes, smelled it with his nose, poked it with his finger. I had already begun to digest my master. He looked in my direction but avoided my gaze, as if he were guilty about something. "You and Ram Persad will both get a better room to sleep in, and separate beds, and some privacy."
"Please don't do that, sir. This place is like a palace for us."
That made him feel better. He looked at me. "You're from Laxmangar, aren't you?"
"Yes, sir."
"I was born in Laxmangar, but I haven't seen it since. Were you born there, too?"
"Yes, sir. Born and raised there."
"What's it like?" Before I could answer, he said, "It must be so nice. Like paradise, sir." He looked me up and down from head to toe, the way I had been looking at him ever since I had come to the house. His eyes seemed full of wonder. How could 2 such contrasting specimens of humanity be produced by the same soil, sunlight, and water? "Well, I want to go there today,"
he said, getting up from the bed. I want to see my birthplace. You'll drive me.
Yes, sir.
Going home, and in my uniform, driving the stork's car, chatting up his son and daughter-in-law. I was ready to fall at his feet and kiss them. The stork had wanted to come along with us, and that would really make it a grand entry for me into the village, but at the last minute he decided to stay back. In the end it was just Mr. Ashok and Pinky Madam, whom I was taking in the Honda City, out into the countryside, toward Laxmangar. It was the first time I was driving the two of them. Ram Prasad had had the privilege until now. I still wasn't used to the Honda City, which is a moody car with a mind of its own, as I've said. I just prayed to the gods, all of them, not to let me make a mistake. They said nothing for half an hour. Sometimes you can feel, as a driver, when there is tension in the car. It raises the temperature inside. The woman inside the car was very angry. Why are we going to this place in the middle of nowhere, Ashoki? Her voice breaking the silence at last. It's my ancestral village, Pinky. Wouldn't you like to see it? I was born there, but father sent me away as a boy. There was some trouble with the communist guerrillas then. I thought we could... Have you decided on a return date? She asked suddenly. I mean to New York. No, not yet. We'll get one soon. He was silent for a minute. My ears were really wide open now. If they went back to America, would they no longer need a second driver in the home? She said nothing, but I swear I could hear teeth gritting. Mr. Ashok had no clue, though. He began humming a film song, until she said, "What a fucking joke." What was that? You lied about returning to America, didn't you, Ashok? You're never going back, are you? There's a driver in the car, Pinky. I'll explain everything later. Oh, what does he matter? He's only the driver, and you're just changing the topic again. A lovely fragrance filled the car, and I knew that she must have moved about and adjusted her clothes. Why do we even need a driver? Why can't you drive like you used to? Pinky, that was New York. You can't drive in India. Just look at this traffic. No one follows any rules. People run across the road like crazy. Look! Look at that! A tractor was coming down the road at full speed, belching out a nice thick plume of black diesel from its exhaust pipe. It's on the wrong side of the road. The driver of that tractor hasn't even noticed. I hadn't noticed either. Well, I suppose you are meant to drive on the left side of the road, but until then I had never known anyone to get agitated over this rule. And just look at the diesel, it's spewing out. If I drive here, Pinky, I'll go completely mad. We drove along a river, and then the tar road came to an end, and I took them along a bumpy track, and then through a small marketplace with three more or less identical shops, selling more or less identical items of kerosene, incense, and rice. Everyone stared at us. Some children began running alongside the car. Mr. Ashok waved at them and tried to get Pinky Madam to do the same. The children disappeared. We had crossed a line they could not follow us beyond. We were in the landlord's quarter. The caretaker was waiting at the gate of the Stork's mansion. He opened the door of the car even before I had brought it to a full stop and touched Mr. Ashok's feet. Little prince, you're here at last, you're here at last. The wild boar came to have lunch with Mr. Ashok and Pinky Madam. He was their uncle, after all. As soon as I saw him enter the mansion for lunch, I went to the kitchen and told the caretaker, I love Mr. Ashok so much, you must let me serve him lunch. The cook agreed, and I got to take my first good look at the wild boar in years. He was older than I remembered, and more bent over, but his teeth were exactly the same, sharp and blackened and with two distinctive hooked ones curving up by the side. They ate in the dining room, a magnificent place with high ceilings, heavy old-fashioned furniture all around, and a huge chandelier. It's a lovely old mansion, Mr. Ashok said. Everything's gorgeous in here. Except the chandelier. It's a bit tacky, she said. Your father loves chandeliers, the wild boar said. He wanted to put one up in the bathroom here. Did you know that? and serious.
When the caretaker brought out the dishes and put them on the table, Mr. Ashok looked at them and said, "Don't you have anything vegetarian? I don't eat meat." "I've never heard of a landlord who was vegetarian," the wild boar said. "It's not natural. You need meat to toughen you up." He opened his lips and showed his curved teeth. "I don't believe in killing animals needlessly. I knew vegetarians in America, and I think they're right." "What crazy ideas do you boys pick up?" the old man said. "You're a landlord. It's the Brahmins who are vegetarian, not us." After lunch, I washed the dishes. I helped the caretaker make tea. My master was taken care of. Now it was time to see my family. I went out the mansion by the back door. Well, they had beaten me to it. My family had all come to the mansion, and they were around the Honda City, staring at it with pride, though too frightened to touch it. Kishan raised his hand. I hadn't seen him since he left Dunbar and came back home to work in the fields. That was 3 months ago. I bent down and touched his feet and held on to them for seconds longer than needed, because I knew the moment I let go, he would bugger me badly. I hadn't sent any money home for the past 2 months. "Oh, so now he remembers his family at last," he said, shaking me off his feet. "Has he thought about us at all?" "Forgive me, brother. You've not sent any money for months. You forgot our arrangement. Forgive me, forgive me." But they weren't really angry. For the first time I can remember, I got more attention than the water buffalo. Most lavish in her fussing naturally was sly old Kusum, who kept grinning at me and rubbing her forearms. "Oh, how I used to stuff your mouth with sweets as a child," she said, trying to squeeze my cheeks. She was too frightened of my uniform to try and touch me anywhere else. They almost carried me on their backs to the old house, I tell you. The neighbors were waiting there to see my uniform. I was shown the children that had been born in the family since I had left, and forced to kiss them on the forehead. My aunt Leila had had 2 children when I was gone. Cousin Papu's wife, Leela, had had a child. The family was larger. The needs were more. I was chastised by all for not sending money each month. Kusum beat her head with her fist. She wailed into the neighbor's house. "My grandson has a job and he still forces me to work. This is the fate of an old woman in this world." "Marry him off," the neighbors yelled. "That's the only way to tame the wild ones like him." "Yes," Kusum said. "Yes, that's a good idea." She grinned and rubbed her forearms. "A very good idea." Kishan had a lot of news for me, and since this was the darkness, all of it was bad news. The great socialist was as corrupt as ever. The fighting between the Naxal terrorists and the landlords was getting bloodier. Small people like us were getting caught in between. There were private armies on both sides, going around to shoot and torture people suspected of sympathizing with the other. "Life has become hell here," he said. "But we're so happy you're out of this mess. You've got a uniform and a good master." Kishan had changed. He was thinner and darker. His neck tendons were sticking out in high relief above the deep clavicles. He had become, all of a sudden, my father. I saw Kusum grinning and rubbing her forearms and talking of my marriage. She served me lunch herself. As she ladled the curry onto my plate, she had made chicken just for me. She said, "We'll fix up the wedding for later this year, okay? We've already found someone for you, a nice plump duck. The moment she has her menstrual cycle, she can come here." There was red curried bone and flesh in front of me, and it seemed to me that they had served me flesh from Kishan's own body on that plate. "Granny," I said, looking at the large piece of red curried meat, "give me some more time. I'm not ready to be married." Her jaw dropped. "What do you mean, not yet? You'll do what we want." She smiled. "Now eat it, dear. I made chicken just for you." I said, "No. Eat it." She pushed the plate closer to me. Everyone in the household stopped to look at our tussle. Granny squinted. "What are you, a Brahmin? Eat, eat." "No." I pushed the plate so hard, it went flying to a corner and hit the wall and spilled the red curry on the floor. "I said I'm not marrying." She was too stunned even to yell. Kishan got up and tried to stop me as I left, but I pushed him to the side. He fell down hard, and I just walked out of the house. The children ran along with me outside, little dirty brats born to one aunt or the other, whose names I did not want to know, whose hair I did not want to touch. Gradually they got the message and went back. I left behind the temple, the market, the hogs, and the sewage. Then I was alone at the pond, the black fort, on the hill up in front of me. Near the water's edge, I sat down, gnashing my teeth. I couldn't stop thinking of Kishan's body. They were eating him alive in there. They would do the same thing to him that they did to father, scoop him out from the inside and leave him weak and helpless until he got tuberculosis and died on the floor of a government hospital, waiting for some doctor to see him, spitting blood on this wall and that. There was a splashing noise. The water buffalo in the pond lifted its water lily-covered head. It peeked at me. A crane stood watching me on one leg. I walked until the water came up to my neck, and then swam, past lotuses and water lilies, past the water buffalo, past tadpoles and fish and giant boulders fallen from the fort. Up on the broken ramparts, the monkeys gathered to look at me. I had started climbing up the hill. You are familiar already with my love of poetry, and especially of the works of the four Muslim poets acknowledged to be the greatest of all time. Now Iqbal, who is one of the four, has written this remarkable poem in which he imagines that he is the devil, standing up for his rights at a moment when God tries to bully him. The devil, according to the Muslims, was once God's sidekick until he fought with him and went freelance, and ever since there has been a war of brains between God and the devil. This is what Iqbal writes about. The exact words of the poem I can't remember, but it goes something like this. God says, I am powerful, I am huge, become my servant again. Devil says, ha! When I remember Iqbal's devil, as I do often, lying here under my chandelier, I think of a little black figure in a wet khaki uniform who is climbing up the entranceway to a black fort. There he stands now, one foot on the ramparts of the black fort, surrounded by a group of amazed monkeys. Up in the blue skies, God spreads his palm over the plains below, showing this little man, Laxmangar, and its little tributary of the Ganga, and all that lies beyond. A million such villages, a billion such people. And God asks this little man, isn't it all wonderful? Isn't it all grand? Aren't you grateful to be my servant? And then I see this small black man in the wet khaki uniform start to shake, as if he has gone mad with anger, before delivering to the Almighty a gesture of thanks for having created the world this particular way, instead of all the other ways it could have been created. I see the little man in the khaki uniform spitting at God again and again, as I watch the black blades of the midget fan slice the light from the chandelier again and again. Half an hour later, when I came down the hill, I went straight to the Stork's mansion. Mr. Ashok and Pinky Madam were waiting for me by the Honda City. "Where the hell have you been, driver?" she yelled. "We've been waiting." "Sorry, madam," I said, grinning to her. "I'm very sorry." "Have a heart, Pinky. He was seeing his family. You know how close they are to their families in the darkness?" Kusum, Lutu Auntie, and all the other women were gathered by the side of the road as we drove out. They gaped at me, stunned that I wasn't coming to apologize. I saw Kusum clench her gnarled fist at me. I put my foot down on the accelerator and drove right past all of them. We went through the market square. I took a look at the tea shop. The human spiders were at work at the tables. The rickshaws were arranged in a line at the back, and the cyclist with the poster for the daily pornographic film on the other side of the river had just begun his rounds. I drove through the greenery, through the bushes and the trees and the water buffaloes lazing in muddy ponds, past the creepers and the bushes, past the paddy fields, past the coconut palms, past the bananas, past the neems and the banyans, past the wild grass, with the faces of the water buffaloes peeping through. A small half-naked boy was riding a buffalo by the side of the road when he saw us. He pumped his fists and shouted in joy, and I wanted to shout back at him, "Yes, I feel that way too. I'm never going back there."
"Can you talk now, Ashoki? Can you answer my question?"
"All right. Look, when I came back, I really thought it was going to be for 2 months, Pinky. But things have changed so much in India. There are so many more things I could do here than in New York now."
"Ashoki, that's bullshit."
"No, it's not. Really, it's not. The way things are changing in India now, this place is going to be like America in 10 years. Plus, I like it better here. We've got people to take care of us here. Our drivers, our watchmen, our masseurs. Where in New York will you find someone to bring you tea and sweet biscuits while you're still lying in bed, the way Ram Bahadur does for us? You know, he's been in my family for 30 years. We call him a servant, but he's part of the family. Dad found this Nepali wandering about Dhanbad one day with a gun in his hand and said..." He stopped talking all at once. "Did you see that, Pinky?"
"What?"
"Did you see what the driver did?" My heart skipped a beat. I had no idea what I had just done. Mr. Ashok leaned forward and said, "Driver, you just touched your finger to your eye, didn't you?"
"Yes, sir."
"Didn't you see, Pinky? We just drove past a temple." Mr. Ashok pointed to the tall conical structure with the black intertwining snakes painted down the sides that we had left behind. "So the driver..." He touched me on the shoulder.
"What is your name?"
"Balram." "So Balram here touched his eye as a mark of respect. The villagers are so religious in the darkness." That seemed to have impressed the two of them, so I put my finger to my eye a moment later again. "What's that for, driver? I don't see any temples around."
"Ah, we drove past a sacred tree, sir. I was offering my respects."
"Did you hear that? They worship nature. It's beautiful, isn't it?" The two of them kept an eye open for every tree or temple we passed by, and turned to me for a reaction of piety, which I gave them, of course, and with growing elaborateness, first just touching my eye, then my neck, then my clavicle, and even my nipples. They were convinced I was the most religious servant on earth. Take that, Ram Prasad. Our way back into Dhanbad was blocked. There was a truck parked on the road. It was full of men with red headbands shouting slogans. "Rise against the rich! Support the great socialist! Keep the landlords out!" Soon another set of trucks drove by. The men in them wore green headbands and shouted at the men in the other truck. A fight was about to break out.
"What's going on?"
Pinky Madam asked in an alarmed tone of voice.
"Relax," he said. "It's election time, that's all."
Now, to explain to you what was going on with all this shouting from the trucks, I will have to tell you all about democracy, something that you Chinese, I am aware, are not very familiar with. But that will have to wait for tomorrow, Your Excellency. It's 2:44 a.m. The hour of degenerates, drug addicts, and Bangalore-based entrepreneurs. The fourth morning. For the desk of... But we don't really need these formalities anymore, do we, Mr. Jabal? We know each other by now. Plus, we don't have the time for formalities, I'm afraid. It'll be a short session today, Mr. Premier. I was listening to a program on the radio about this man called Castro, who threw the rich out of his country and freed his people. I love listening to programs about great men. And before I knew it, it had turned to 2 a.m. I wanted to hear more about this Castro, but for your sake I've turned the radio off. I'll resume the story exactly where we left off. Oh, democracy! Now, Mr. Premier, the little take-home pamphlet that you will be given by the Prime Minister will no doubt contain a very large section on the splendor of democracy in India, the awe-inspiring spectacle of 1 billion people casting their votes to determine their own future in full freedom of franchise and so on and so forth. I gather you yellow-skinned men, despite your triumphs in sewage, drinking water and Olympic gold medals, still don't have democracy. Some politician on the radio was saying that that's why we Indians are going to beat you. We may not have sewage, drinking water and Olympic gold medals, but we do have democracy. If I were making a country, I'd get the sewage pipes first, then the democracy, then I'd go about giving pamphlets and statues of Gandhi to other people. But what do I know? I'm just a murderer. I've got no problem with democracy, Mr. Jabbaw. Far from it. I owe democracy a lot. Even my birthday, in fact. This was back in the days when I was smashing coals and wiping tables at the tea shop in Laxmangar. There was a clapping from the direction of the portrait of Gandhi. The old tea shop owner began shouting that all his workers had to leave whatever they were doing and march to the school. A man in a government uniform sat at the teacher's desk in the schoolroom with a long book and black pen, and he was asking everyone 2 questions. Name? Balaram Halwe. Age? No age. No date of birth? No, sir. My parents didn't make note of it. He looked at me and said, I think you're 18. I think you turned 18 today. You just forgot, didn't you? I bowed to him. That's correct, sir. I forgot. It was my birthday today. Good boy. And then he wrote that down in his book and told me to go away. So I got a birthday from the government. I had to be 18. All of us in the tea shop had to be 18, the legal age to vote. There was an election coming up, and the tea shop owner had already sold us. He had sold our fingerprints, the inky fingerprints which the illiterate person makes on the ballot paper to indicate his vote. I had overheard this from a customer. This was supposed to be a close election. He had got a good price for each one of us from the Great Socialist's party. Now, the Great Socialist had been the boss of the darkness for a decade at the time of this election. His party symbol, a pair of hens breaking through handcuffs, symbolizing the poor, shaking off the rich, was imprinted in black stencils on the walls of every government office in the darkness. Some of the customers at the tea shop said the Great Socialist started off as a good man. He had come to clean things up, but the mud of Mother Ganga had sucked him in. Others said he was dirty from the start, but he had just fooled everyone, and only now did we see him for what he was. Whatever the case was, no one seemed able to vote him out of power. He had ruled the darkness, winning election after election, but now his rule was weakening. You see, a total of 93 criminal cases for murder, rape, grand larceny, gun running, pimping, and many other such minor offences are pending against the Great Socialist and his ministers at the present moment. Not easy to get convictions when the judges are judging in darkness, yet 3 convictions have been delivered, and 3 of the ministers are currently in jail but continue to be ministers. The Great Socialist himself is said to have embezzled 1 billion rupees from the darkness and transferred that money into a bank account in a small, beautiful country in Europe, full of white people and black money. Now that the date for the elections had been set and declared on radio, election fever had started spreading again. These are the 3 main diseases of this country, sir. Typhoid, cholera, and election fever. This last one is the worst. It makes people talk and talk about things that they have no say in. The Great Socialist's enemies seem to be stronger this election than at the last one. They had made pamphlets and went about on buses and trucks with microphones and announced they were going to topple him over and drag the river Ganga and everyone who lived on its banks out of the darkness and into the light. At the tea shop, the gossip grew furious. People sipped their tea and discussed the same things again and again. Would they do it this time? Would they beat the Great Socialist and win the elections? Had they raised enough money of their own and bribed enough policemen and bought enough fingerprints of their own to win? Like eunuchs discussing the Kama Sutra, the voters discussed the elections in Laxmangar. One morning I saw a policeman writing a slogan on the wall outside the temple with a red paintbrush. "Do you want good roads, clean water, good hospitals? Then vote out the great socialist." For years there was a deal between the landlords and the great socialist. Everyone in the village knew about this. But this year something had gone wrong with the deal, so the four animals had joined together and started a party of their own. And below the slogan, the policeman wrote, "All India Social Progressive Front Leninist Faction," which was the name of the landlord's party. In the weeks before the elections, trucks bumped up and down the dirty streets of Laxmangar, full of young men holding microphones. "Stand up to the rich!" Vijay, the bus conductor, was always on one of these trucks. He had quit his old job and joined politics now. That was the thing about Vijay. Each time you saw him, he had done better for himself. He was a born politician. He wore a red headband to show that he was one of the great socialist supporters and made speeches every morning in front of the tea shop. The landlords brought in trucks full of their own supporters in retaliation, and from these trucks men shouted out, "Roads, water, hospitals, vote out the great socialist." A week before the elections, both sides stopped sending out their trucks. I heard what had happened while cleaning up a table. The animal's bluff had worked. The great socialist had agreed to cut a deal with them. Vijay bowed down and touched the feet of the stork at a big rally in front of the tea shop. It seemed that all differences had been patched, and the stork had been named the president of the Laxmangar branch of the great socialist's party. Vijay was to be his deputy. Now the rallies were done. The priest celebrated a special puja to pray for the great socialist's victory. Mutton biryani was distributed on paper plates in front of the temple, and in the evening there was free hooch for all. Lots of dust and policemen came into the village next morning. One officer read out voting instructions in the marketplace. Whatever was being done for our own good. The great socialists' enemies would try and steal the election from us, the poor, and take the power away from us, the poor, and put those shackles back on our hands that he, the great socialist, had so lovingly taken off our hands. Did we understand? And then in a cloud of dust, the police drove off. "It's the way it always is," my father told me that night. "I've seen 12 elections, 5 general, 5 state, 2 local, and someone else has voted for me 12 times. I've heard that people in the other India get to vote for themselves. Isn't that something?" On the day of the election, one man went mad. This happens every time at every election in the darkness. One of my father's colleagues, a small dark-skinned man whom no one had taken any notice of until now, was surrounded by a mob of rickshaw pullers, including my father. They were trying to dissuade him, but only half-heartedly. They had seen this thing happening before. They wouldn't be able to stop this man now. Every now and then, even in a place like Laxmangar, a ray of sunlight will break through. All these posters and speeches and slogans on the wall, maybe they get into a man's head. He declares himself a citizen of the democracy of India and he wants to cast his vote. That was where this rickshaw puller had got to. He declared himself free of the darkness. He had made his Benares that day. He began walking straight to the voting booth at the school. "I'm supposed to stand up to the rich, aren't I?" he shouted. "Isn't that what they keep telling us?" When he got there, the great socialist supporters had already put up the tally of votes outside on a blackboard. They had counted 2,341 votes in that booth. Everyone had voted for the great socialist. Vijay, the bus conductor, was up on a ladder, hammering into the wall a banner with the great socialist symbol, the hands breaking their shackles. The slogan on the banner said, "Congratulations to the great socialist on his unanimous victory from Laxmangar." Vijay dropped the hammer, the nails, and the banner when he saw the rickshaw puller. "What are you doing here?" "Voting," he shouted back. "Isn't it the election today?" I cannot confirm what happened next, even though I was only a few feet behind him. A big crowd had gathered to watch him from a distance. But when the policeman charged at us, we turned and ran in a stampede, so I never saw what they did to that brave, mad man. I heard about it the next day, while pretending to scratch a dirty spot out of a tabletop. Vijay and a policeman had knocked the rickshaw puller down, and they had begun beating him. They hit him with their sticks, and when he thrashed at them, they kicked him. They took turns. Vijay hit him, and the policeman stamped on his face, and then Vijay did it again. And after a while, the body of the rickshaw puller stopped wriggling and fighting back, but they kept stamping on him, until he had been stamped back into the earth. If I may go back for a moment to that wanted poster, Your Excellency, being called a murderer, fine, I have no objection to that. It's a fact. I am a sinner, a fallen human, but to be called a murderer by the police. What a fucking joke! Here's a little souvenir of your Indian visit to keep with you. Balaram Halwe is a vanished man, a fugitive, someone whose whereabouts are unknown to the police, right? Ha! The police know exactly where to find me. They will find me dutifully voting on election day at the voting booth in the school compound in Laxmangar in Gaya district, as I have done in every general, state, and local election since I turned 18. I am India's most faithful voter, and I still have not seen the inside of a voting booth. Now, though the elections were due soon in Dhanbad, life went on as ever within the high walls of the Stork's house. He sighed as his legs were pressed in warm water. Games of cricket and badminton went on around him, and I washed and cleaned the two Pomeranian dogs faithfully. Then one day a familiar face turned up at the gate. Vijay, the bus conductor from Laxmangar. My childhood hero had a new uniform this time. He was dressed all in white, and wore a white Nehru cap on his head, and had rings of solid gold on 8 of his fingers. Public service had been good to him. I waited by the gate and watched. The stork himself came out to see Vijay and bowed down before him, a landlord bowing down before a pig-herd's son. The marvels of democracy. 2 days later, the great socialist came to the house. The entire household was abuzz because of the visit. Mr. Ashok stood at the gate, waiting with a garland of jasmine flowers. His brother and his father were by his side. A car came to the gate. Its door opened, and then the face I had seen on a million election posters since I was a boy emerged. I saw the puffy cheeks, the spiky white hair, the thick gold earrings. Vijay was wearing his red headband today, and holding up the flag with the breaking shackle symbol. He shouted, "Long live the great socialist!" The great man folded his palms and bowed all around him. He had one of those either-or faces that all great Indian politicians have. This face says that it is now at peace, and you can be at peace too, if you follow the owner of that face. But the same face can also say, with a little twitch of its features, that it has known the opposite of peace, and it can make this other fate yours too, if it so wishes. Mr. Ashok put the garland on the great man's thick, bull-like neck. "My son," the stork said, "returned from America recently." The great socialist squeezed Mr. Ashok's cheeks. "Good. We need more boys to come back and build India into a superpower." And then they went into the house, and all the doors and windows were closed. After a while, the great socialist came out into the courtyard, followed by the old man, the mongoose, and Mr. Ashok. I was trying to overhear them, and so pretended to be sweeping the ground, while inching closer and closer to them. I had swept myself right into hearing distance, when the great socialist tapped me on the back. "What's your name, son?" he asked. Then he said, "Your employers are trying to bugger me, Balram. What do you say to this?" Mr. Ashok looked stunned. The stork simpered. "A million and a half is a lot, sir. We'll be happy to come to a settlement with you." The great socialist waved his hands as if dismissing that plea. Bullshit. You've got a good scam going here. Taking coal for free from the government mines. You've got it going because I let it happen. You were just some little village landlord when I found you. I brought you here. I made you what you are today, and by God, you cross me and you'll go back there into that village. I said 1.5 million, and I mean 1 million and... He had to stop. He had been chewing pan, and now his mouth had filled up with red spittle, which was beginning to dribble out. He turned to me and made the shape of a bowl with his hands. I rushed to the Honda City to get the spittoon. When I came back with the spittoon, he coolly turned to the mongoose and said, "Son, won't you hold the spittoon for me?" The mongoose refused to move, so the great socialist took the spittoon from my hands and held it out. "Take it, son." The mongoose took it. Then the great socialist spat into the spittoon 3 times. The mongoose's hands trembled. His face turned black with shame. "Thank you for that, son," the great socialist said, wiping his lips. He turned to me and tickled his forehead. Where was I now? There you have it. That was the positive side of the great socialist. He humiliated all our masters. That's why we kept voting him back in. That night, on the pretext again of sweeping the courtyard, I got close to the stork and his sons. They were sitting on a bench, holding glasses of golden liquor and talking. Mukesh Sir had just finished. The old man shook his head. "We can't do that, Mukesh. We need him." "I'm telling you, Father, we don't anymore. We can go straight to Delhi. We know people there now." "I agree with Mukesh, Father. We shouldn't let him treat us like this anymore. Like we're his slaves." "Quiet, Ashok. Let Mukesh and me discuss this." I swept the courtyard twice over and listened. Then I began tightening Pinky Madam's sagging badminton net so I could stay near them. But a pair of suspicious Nepali eyes spotted me out. "Don't loiter in the courtyard. Go and sit in your room and wait for the masters to call you." "All right." Ram Bahadur glared at me, so I said, "All right, sir." Servants, incidentally, are obsessed with being called sir by other servants, sir. The next morning, when I was blow-drying puddles and cuddles after having shampooed them, Ram Bahadur came up to me and said, "Have you ever been to Delhi?" I shook my head. "They're going to Delhi in a week, Mr. Ashok and Pinky Madam. They're going to leave for 3 months." I got down on my knees and directed the blow-dryer under Cuddles's legs, pretending not to be interested, and asked as casually as I could, "Why?" The Nepali shrugged. "Who knew? We were just servants." One thing, though, he did know. "Only one driver will be taken along, and this driver will get 3,000 rupees a month. That's how much they'll pay him in Delhi." The blow-dryer fell out of my hand. "Serious? 3,000? "Yes." "Will they take me along, sir?" I got up and asked pleadingly. "Can't you make them take me?" "They'll take Ram Prasad," he said with a sneer of his Nepali lips. "Unless..."
"Unless?"
He minted coins with his fingers. 5,000 rupees, and he would tell the stork that I was the man to be taken along to Delhi. 5,000? Where will I get such money? My family steals my whole paycheck. "Oh, well, in that case, it'll be Ram Prasad. As for you..." He pointed to Cuddles and Puddles. "You'll be cleaning the dogs for the rest of your life, I guess." I woke up, both nostrils burning. It was still dark. Ram Prasad was up. He was sitting on his bed, chopping onions on a wooden board. I heard the tuck, tuck, tuck of his knife hitting the board. "What the hell is he chopping onions so early for?" I thought, turning to a side and closing my eyes again. I wanted to go back to sleep, but the tuck, tuck, tuck of the knife hitting the board insisted. This man had a secret. I stayed awake while the man on the bed chopped onions. I tried to figure it out. What had I noticed about Ram Prasad in the past few days? For one thing, his breath had gone bad. Even Pinky Madam complained. he had suddenly stopped eating with us, either inside the house or outside. Even on Sundays when there would be chicken, Ramprasad would refuse to eat with us, saying he had already done so, or he wasn't hungry, or... The chopping of the onions continued, and I kept adding thought to thought in the dark. I watched him all day. Toward evening, as I was expecting, he began moving to the gate. From my conversation with the cook, I had learned that Ramprasad had started to head out of the house at the same time every evening. I followed at a distance. He went into a part of the city I had never seen before, and walked around a few alleys. At one point I distinctly saw him turn around, as if to make sure no one was following him. Then he darted. He had stopped in front of a two-story building. The wall had a large metal grill divided into square units. A series of small black taps jutted out from the wall below the grill. He bent down to a tap, washed his face and gargled and spat. Then he took off his sandals. Shoes and sandals had been folded and stuffed into the squares of the grill. He did the same with his sandals. Then he went into the building and closed the door. I slapped my forehead. What a fool I'd been! It's Ramadan. They can't eat and drink during the day. I ran back to the house and found the Nepali. He was standing at the gate, rubbing his teeth with a twig broken from a neem tree, which is what many poor people in my country do, Mr. Premier, when they want to clean their teeth. I just saw a film, sir. Fuck off. A great film, sir. Lots of dancing. Hero was a Muslim. Name of Muhammad Muhammad. Don't waste my time, boy. Go clean the car if you've got nothing to do. Now, this Muhammad Muhammad was a poor, honest, hard-working Muslim, but he wanted a job at the home of an evil, prejudiced landlord who didn't like Muslims. So just to get a job and feed his starving family, he claimed to be a Hindu and took the name of Ram Persad. The twig fell out of the Nepali's mouth. And you know how he managed to pull this off? Because the Nepali guard at this house, whom the masters trusted absolutely, and who was supposed to check up on Ramprasad's background, was in on the scam. Before he could run, I caught him by the collar. Technically, in these servant versus servant affairs, that is all you need to do to indicate, I have won. But if you're going to do these things, it's better to do them in style, right? So I slapped him too. I was servant number one from now on in this household. I ran back to the mosque. Namaz must have ended by now. And indeed Ramprasad, or Muhammad, or whatever his name really was, came out of the mosque, took his sandals down from the window, slapped them on the ground, wriggled his feet into them, and began walking out. He saw me. I winked at him, and he knew that the game was up. I did the needful in a few precise words. Then I went back to the house. The Nepali was watching me from behind the black bars. I took his keychain from him and put it in my pocket. Get me some tea and biscuits. I pinched his shirt. And I want your uniform, too. Mine is getting old. I slept in the bed that night. In the morning, someone came into the room. It was ex-driver number one. Without a word to me, he began packing. All his things fitted into one small bag. I thought, what a miserable life he's had, having to hide his religion, his name, just to get a job as a driver. And he is a good driver, no question of it, a far better one than I will ever be. Part of me wanted to get up and apologize to him right there and say, you go and be a driver in Delhi. You never did anything to hurt me. Forgive me, brother. I turned to the other side, farted, and went back to sleep. When I woke up, he was gone. He had left all his images of gods behind, and I scooped them into a bag. You never know when those things can come in handy. In the evening, the Nepali came to me with a grin on his face, the same fake servant's grin he showed to the stork all day long. He told me that since Ramprasad had left their service without a word, I would be driving Mr. Ashok and Pinky Madam to Delhi. He had personally and forcefully recommended my name to the stork. I went back to my bed, all mine now, stretched out on it and said, "Great. Now clean those webs off the ceiling, won't you?" He glared at me but said nothing and went away to get a broom. I shouted, "Sir!" From then on, every morning, it was hot Nepali tea and some nice sugar biscuits on a porcelain platter. Kishan came to the gate that Sunday and heard the news from me. I thought he was going to bugger me now for how abruptly I had left them at the village, but he was overcome with joy. His eyes were full of tears. Someone in his family was going to make it out of the darkness and into New Delhi. "It's just like our mother always said. She knew you were going to make it." 2 days later, I was driving Mr. Ashok, the mongoose, and Pinky Madam to Delhi in the Honda City. It wasn't hard to find the way. I just had to follow the buses. For there were buses and jeeps all along the road, and they were bursting with passengers, who packed the insides and hung out the doors and even got on the roofs. They were all headed from the darkness to Delhi. You'd think the whole world was migrating. Every time we passed by one of these buses, I had to grin. I wished I could roll down the window and yell at them, "I'm going to Delhi in a car, an air-conditioned car." But I'm sure they saw the words in my eyes. Around noon, Mr. Ashok tapped me on the shoulder. "From the start, sir, there was a way in which I could understand what he wanted to say, the way dogs understand their masters. I stopped the car, and then moved to my left, and he moved to his right, and our bodies passed each other, so close that the stubble on his face scraped my cheeks, like the shaving brush that I use every morning, and the cologne from his skin, a lovely rich fruity cologne, rushed into my nostrils for a heady instant, while the smell of my servant's sweat rubbed off onto his face, and then he became driver, and I became passenger. He started the car. The mongoose, who had been reading a newspaper the whole time, now saw what had happened. "Don't do this, Ashok." He was an old schoolmaster, the mongoose. He knew right from wrong. "You're right. This feels weird," Mr. Ashok said. The car came to a stop. Our bodies crossed each other again. Our scents were exchanged once more, and I was again the driver and servant, and Mr. Ashok was again the passenger and master. We reached Delhi late at night. It is not yet 3. I could go on a little while longer. But I want to stop, because from here on I have to tell you a new kind of story. Remember, Mr. Premier, the first time, perhaps as a boy, when you opened the hood of a car and looked into its entrails? Remember the colored wires twisting from one part of the engine to the other? The black box full of yellow caps? Enigmatic tubes hissing out steam and oil and grease everywhere. Remember how mysterious and magical everything seemed. When I peer into the portion of my story that unfolds in New Delhi, I feel the same way. If you ask me to explain how one event connects to another, or how one motive strengthens or weakens the next, or how I went from thinking this about my master to thinking that, I will tell you that I myself don't understand these things. I cannot be certain that the story, as I will tell it, is the right story to tell. I cannot be certain that I know exactly why Mr. Ashok died. It will be good for me to stop here. When we meet again, at midnight, remind me to turn the chandelier up a bit. The story gets much darker from here. The fourth night. I should like to talk a little more about this chandelier. Why not? I've got no family anymore. All I've got is chandeliers. I have a chandelier here above my head in my office, and then I have 2 in my apartment in Raj Mahal Villas Phase 2, one in the drawing room and a small one in the toilet, too. It must be the only toilet in Bangalore with a chandelier. I saw all these chandeliers one day, tied to the branch of a big banyan tree near Lal Bagh Gardens. A boy from a village was selling them, and I bought all of them on the spot. I paid some fellow with a bullock cart to bring them home, and we went riding through Bangalore, me and this fellow and 4 chandeliers on a limousine powered by bulls. It makes me happy to see a chandelier. Why not?
I'm a free man. Let me buy all the chandeliers I want. For one thing, they keep the lizards away from this room. It's the truth, sir. Lizards don't like the light. So as soon as they see a chandelier, they stay away. I don't understand why other people don't buy chandeliers all the time and put them up everywhere. Free people don't know the value of freedom. That's the problem. Sometimes in my apartment, I turn on both chandeliers, and then I lie down amid all that light, and I just start laughing, a man in hiding, and yet he's surrounded by chandeliers. There, I'm revealing the secret to a successful escape. The police searched for me in darkness, but I hid myself in light. In Bangalore. Now, among the many uses of a chandelier, the most unsung and unloved object is that when you forget something, all you have to do is stare at the glass pieces shining in the ceiling long enough, and within 5 minutes you'll remember exactly what it is you were trying to remember. See, I'd forgotten where we left off the story last night, so I had to go on about chandeliers for a while, keeping you busy, but now I remember where we were. Delhi. We had got to Delhi last night when I stopped the narrative. The capital of our glorious nation, the seat of parliament, of the president, of all ministers and prime ministers, the pride of our civic planning, the showcase of the republic. That's what they call it. Let a driver tell you the truth, and the truth is that Delhi is a crazy city. See, the rich people live in big housing colonies like Defense Colony, or Greater Kailash, or Vasant Kunj, and inside their colonies the houses have numbers and letters, but this numbering and lettering system follows no known system of logic. For instance, in the English alphabet, A is next to B, which everyone knows, even people like me who don't know English. But in a colony, one house is called A231, and the next is F378. So one time, Pinky Madam wanted me to take her to Greater Kailash E231. I tracked down the houses to E200, and just when I thought we were almost there, E block vanished completely. The next house was S something. Pinky Madam began yelling, "I told you not to bring this hick from the village." And then another thing. Every road in Delhi has a name like Aurangazeb Road, or Humayun Road, or Archbishop Makarios Road. And no one, masters or servants, knows the name of the road. You ask someone, "Where's Nikolai Copernicus Marg?" And he could be a man who lived on Nikolai Copernicus Marg his whole life, and he'll open his mouth and say, "Huh?" Or he'll say, "Straight ahead, then turn left," even though he has no idea. And all the roads look the same. All of them go around and around grassy circles, in which men are sleeping or eating or playing cards, and then four roads shoot off from that grassy circle, and then you go down one road, and you hit another grassy circle where men are sleeping or playing cards, and then four more roads go off from it. So you just keep getting lost and lost and lost in Delhi. Thousands of people live on the sides of the road in Delhi. They have come from the darkness too. You can tell by their thin bodies, filthy faces, by the animal-like way they live under the huge bridges and overpasses, making fires and washing and taking lice out of their hair while the cars roar past them. These homeless people are a particular problem for drivers. They never wait for a red light, simply dashing across the road on impulse. And each time I braked to avoid slamming the car into one of them, the shouting would start from the passenger's seat. But I ask you, who built Delhi in this crazy way? Which geniuses were responsible for making F block come after A block, and house number 69 come after house number 12? Who was so busy partying and drinking English liquor and taking their Pomeranian dogs for walks and shampoos that they gave the roads names that no one could remember? Are you lost again, driver? Don't go after him again. Why do you always defend him, Ashok? Don't we have more serious things to discuss? Why are we always talking about this driver? All right, let's discuss the other things then. First, let's discuss your wife and her temper tantrums. Do you really think that's more important than the tax thing? I keep asking you, what are we going to do about it, and you keep changing the topic. I think it's insane how much they're asking us to pay.
I told you, it's a political